When Dan Le Batard calls, you answer the phone. In his podcast, South Beach Sessions, Dan asked me to be the guest, and you can check it out as well as the Hoop Collective podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
Hello, it's Dan Le Batard, and one of the things we want to do here on South Beach Sessions is we want you to get to know the people who are in and around ESPN, personalities that you may think you know, but there's a human being underneath the takes and the reporting, and I find that Brian Windhorst, the person that I admire the way he does his job, I find him hugely interesting because of the way he's done his job, because of how well he's covered LeBron, because of how fairly he has covered LeBron, because of how objective he has tried to remain during a time where that's harder and harder in media. And also, I learned very recently that he was in a coma not that long ago for a good amount of time, for 3 weeks. And so I want to talk to him about that as well. Before we do so, though, I want you to know that we need you to support the people who support us. So Mike Ryan will tell you about ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is one of the title sponsors on everything we're doing here, Le Batard and Friends. And so we ask you to go check out what they're doing as a courtesy to us so we could keep all this stuff funded and paid. Mike, tell them about ZipRecruiter.
That's right, Dan. It's ZipRecruiter time. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. And as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each and every one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. Right now, we want all of you great South Beach Session listeners to check out ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Again, do that for us. If it doesn't cost you anything, just go to the website and check it out, because ZipRecruiter has been a very good sponsor to us, and it can be a hard thing to be a sponsor for us sometimes. Here he is, Brian Windhorst. This is Dan Le Batard, and one of the things that I want to do with South Beach Sessions is sort of introduce you to people, sides of people that perhaps you haven't seen before. And this guy is someone I admire who's come up through our building in a unique way. He does journalism the right way, super credible. You guys have been mean to him because people can be mean, and he has endured some things in his life, and he has come back from the brink of death. And Brian Windhorst, there are very few people at this company as good at what they do, honest to God, as Brian Windhorst is. And many of you think, oh, he's just a LeBron guy. He's a remora fish. It's just feeding off of LeBron James. This dude carved a totally unique path for himself from a small place to the worldwide leader in sports. And he's got a new book, LeBron Inc., The Making of a Billion-Dollar Athlete. It's available now. And I want you to know, Brian, because I haven't told you this before. I've known you for a long time. I was introduced to you like a lot of people were 8 years ago or 9 years ago when you burst onto the scene as the LeBron guy, the guy who had access to LeBron, and you parlayed that into just a wonderful freedom at the company to do your job well. So I'm happy that you're having this success and that this book is something that you're associated with. So thank you for being on here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the new book is LeBron, Inc., The Making of a Billion-Dollar Athlete. It is available now, and you should check it out because he continues to find new ways to write about LeBron, which, Brian, it's got to be hard at this point for you, no? Like, I mean, you have been the LeBron James beat reporter for almost a decade.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much done with it now. I mean, I really, especially this last season, I haven't talked to LeBron in six-plus months. And I was not really compelled at all by the Lakers season this year, even before it went south. You know, at the end of his career, maybe there'll be retrospectives and stuff. And, of course, the Lakers will be relevant now. But I probably done doing big sweeping stuff on him for the time being. This book, it came out in the spring. You know, the last book that I did, which was on their championship in Cleveland, which was really a layup book because on the last page they won. This book, it made bestseller list, which was cool. And so the publisher was like, hey, we'd like you to do another LeBron book. And I'm like, well, I can't do another LeBron basketball project. I just can't. So this was a project about his business. And really, that's a big part of what's going on. Right now, he's shooting a movie. And his business is really a lot of what's mostly interesting with him. His, one of his business partners, Rich Paul, just did a major agent deal. I mean, their business is to me what's more fascinating than the basketball. The basketball story is mostly written.
Well, what's interesting about it? Because I want to get into your life and your journey, but what is interesting to you about the making of a billion-dollar athlete? Because you have watched this from an impoverished place, as you've known LeBron since he was, what, 14 years old?
Yeah, when he was 14. You know, the thing is, like, so many people took advantage of him, but not, like, in a sinister way, just in the way that the system allows. At some point, he was probably maybe 19 or 20, 21. It was early. It was like, I cannot be properly rewarded or compensated for what I do, what I provide to my team, what I provide to my franchise, the league, etc. So
City's economy. Like, he's, by any definition in a salary cap sport, he has been wildly underpaid given what his actual value has been.
Right. So he started this crusade. I'm going to start capturing some damn value. You know, there's this rush of cash that was flying out or flying past him that he was creating. And he's like, instead of having a bucket to capture it, I might try to dam off some of it and capture some of it. So that's what this book is about, is him figuring out ways to try to capture the revenue that he's creating. Some of it has been stuff that other business people have done. Some of it has been stuff that other athletes have done. But all told, there's really nobody who, from a business standpoint, has done some of the stuff that he's done. So it's all tied to basketball.
What's creative there, Brian? What are the specifics of what you're thinking of? LeBron James is a businessman, as somebody who is, he did things. Jordan was just with a sneaker company. What LeBron is doing here is clearly empowering his friends, using that empowerment to sell in Hollywood among famous people, where he knows that fame sells. He's gone to Hollywood as a mogul as much as a basketball player.
Right. So one of the things he figured out pretty early on was he didn't want to be an employee. He wanted to be a stakeholder. You know, you can't own the team that fits you play for, even though, in fairness, you probably should. So he's like, I'm going to own everything I possibly can. So he really became focused in, I'm not going to take as many checks for doing commercials. Now, he still does some of that, but he does way less than he used to. Like, you don't see LeBron on many commercials anymore. I mean, obviously, it still happens somewhat, but Blake Griffin and James Harden have been more ubiquitous on commercials the last 6-7 years than LeBron has. So one of the deals that he did that was really unique was he got 2% of the Liverpool Football Club, which is the soccer team in Liverpool, England, which right now Champions League champions. They won the, you know, the European League, the Champions League, one of the biggest trophies you can win in soccer.
How did he know to do that?
Basically, he surrounded himself with some people who were like, how can we capture value? And these guys who own the Boston Red Sox, John Henry and Tom Werner, they owned the Red Sox, and they really wanted to be in business with LeBron James. So, okay, what can you do to be in business with LeBron? Well, some people have said, let's have LeBron pitch our product. Let's sign him to an endorsement deal, and we'll pay him money, and he can pitch our product. Well, LeBron wasn't interested in that anymore by this time. This was about 2011, actually his first year with the Heat. So he did this deal with Fenway Sports Group, the company that owns the Red Sox. They wanted to do a deal. So he said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I will let you say that I am with your company, and you can pitch me around globally. You can go make deals. You can go find deals for me globally where I'll endorse products. And in return, I want to be a part of your purchase of the Liverpool Football Club that you're just about to make. So they own a NASCAR racing team. They own the Red Sox. And they had just bought Liverpool. And they got it at a steal. John Henry, who has been a financial genius throughout his life, got Liverpool basically at a preposterous discount. I can't remember the conversion, pounds versus dollars, but he basically got them for, I think, around, please don't hold me to this exact number because I don't have it in front of me, like $600 or $700 million, and he let LeBron in at 2%. Now, there's a lot of people that have money that would want to join that ownership group, but you can't join it unless you have an in, you know? And so basically LeBron traded the right to become a 2% partner of Liverpool because those guys really just wanted to be in business with him. He's really only done a couple of deals with them. Like, he did a deal with them for Dunkin' Donuts where if you were in China and you went to a Dunkin' Donuts, there would be a cutout of LeBron. You'd take your picture next to him. That was like one of the deals that they made. And they made a deal.
So he's with bare minimum effort, lending his name to something. You're going to tell me he makes, you know, tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, so now Liverpool is one of the most profitable soccer teams in the world. They just won the Champions League. And if they sold today, they would sell probably in the neighborhood of $3 billion. And so his investment at 2%, you know, is increased like a bunch of times over. And so now, yeah, when you think of LeBron's net worth, you think, oh, yeah, he's got this Nike contract. Oh, yeah, he makes so much money from the Lakers. Well, he could sell that 2% and probably pocket like $60 or $70 million. So that's an example of a creative deal that he did that your average athlete isn't doing, but totally is taking advantage of his name and his opportunity to grab value. He's not the first person in the world to say, hey, it's better to be the owner of something than an employee. I realize that. But he recognized that when he was like 21. And one of the things that happened when he came out of high school, so he got this big, giant Nike deal, which he actually turned down more from Reebok, which I've written about a lot. But
what were the numbers?
Reebok was offering, depending on bonuses and everything like that, in the neighborhood of 110 to 120 million. And Nike signed him for 7 years and 87 million guaranteed. And there was all these perks with the Reebok deal. And he turned down 30 some million dollars more to stay with Nike. Now, granted, we're not going to sit here and wipe our tears because he's still got, you know, almost $90 million guaranteed. But the concept that you as a 18-year-old would not take the most money possible. And my favorite part of that story, and I've told it many times over, and even LeBron's told it, but just in case you haven't heard it, Reebok tried to shock and awe him. They had the first meeting, and at this point he was a senior in high school, had gone to school that day. They sent their private jet to pick him up. They sent a limo to the school. He walked out of school, got in the limo, went to the airport, got on Reebok's private jet, flew to Massachusetts from Akron, and they offered, and it was a Thursday. He was flying back that night and going to school the next day. They offered him a $10 million cashier's check that he could take with him and deposit in the morning if he was willing to sign right there.
Agreed right there. That's what Don King used to do to Ali. He just put like a suitcase with $1 million in it. You know, taking advantage of the idea that Ali didn't know his worth and you'd always be short-sighted enough to just take the suitcase full of cash.
I don't think they were trying to screw him over. They were still offering him $100 million. But, I mean, the concept was, this kid actually knew he was going to be a millionaire, but he didn't have he wasn't a millionaire yet. And his mom was still living in government assisted housing. He didn't have the money yet. So the concept that in the morning he could have been a multimillionaire and he had the ability to walk away from that and then still take less money showed. But anyway, he was going to then make a deal for a beverage contract. That's what you did when you came out as a big time player. You made a shoe deal and you made a beverage deal. It's a little different today. And Pepsi made him an offer. Coca-Cola made him an offer. Gatorade was interested in him. And then, you know, it wasn't really a startup. They were a few years old, but they were mostly in, like, health food stores called Vitamin Water. Said, hey, we want you to be the face of Vitamin Water, and we know that we can't offer you the same amount as Coke. So we'll instead of offering you just money, we'll offer you a percentage of the company. And at that point, he wasn't in that frame of mind, and he got, like, a $15 million deal from Coke. And he, by the way, he's still with Coke 16 years later. He's extended the deal two or three more times. It's been a good partnership for him. He's made tens of millions of dollars with them. But he passed up on Vitamin Water because he said he wanted to take the sure thing and not the ownership stake. Well, Vitamin Water, like, two or three years later, sold for $4 billion.
And, like, 50 Cent got a bunch of that money instead of him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 50 Cent got tens of millions. David Wright got millions. I think Tracy McGrady was one of the players they were able to get. He wet his beak a little bit. But, like, that was, like, a thing where, like, man, I maybe could have made tens of millions in one fell swoop. So that was one of the deals LeBron has taken and turned down dozens and dozens and dozens of deals. That's not – there have been plenty other ones that he turned down that were smart. I'm not saying it was just that. But that was an instructive moment for him where it was like, hey, maybe I should look at a different way to capture value. So that's really been what he's done. And, like, let me just give you an example of how these guys operate. So people have been trying to get LeBron to do Space Jam for 7 or 8 years. I can even remember there was this guy, I won't say who he is because he's kind of a public figure, came to me at one point, like maybe 6 years ago looking for advice on how he could get LeBron to say yes to Space Jam because he was trying to put it together. And Warner Brothers owned the rights. And before LeBron said yes to Space Jam, he got into business with Warner Brothers and had them invest in his production company. And then he had a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. Oh, well, Time Warner was the parent company. One of the subsidiaries was Bleacher Report. Bleacher Report invested in Uninterrupted, like, I think, $15 million. He did a deal with Warner Brothers where they invested in his production company, Spring Hill. And then, after all that, he agreed to put Space Jam together. But he wasn't just going to take a check to go make Space Jam. So these guys do not bat a thousand. They screw up things. This happened when he was in Miami. You remember the Sheets energy strips? Do you remember that? Take the sheet. And LeBron did a commercial, before I play a big game, I take the sheet. That thing, they raised like $10 or $15 million for advertising, and the thing went belly up. It was a failure. So, look, he doesn't bat a thousand, but
those that was a funny one, though. That one was a disastrous deal. I felt like their whole business plan was just, hey, we'll do this take a sheet thing, and people will think it sounds like take a shit, and it'll be funny. Give me $15 million.
Whatever it was a mistake. It didn't work. So they have losses, for sure, some of the stuff that they have made.
But how does this work, Brian, if I may? Forgive me for the interruption. Yeah. But, like, LeBron, in terms of his top five places where he gets revenue, basketball is where? Basketball falls how low?
It's number one now. It wasn't for a long time, because one of the things that irritated LeBron was that he was never the highest paid player on his team until he was like 12 years in the league. And it's one of the reasons why after he left the Heat, he basically said, I'm only playing for a max contract. Even though the difference from what he got with the Heat versus what he would have gotten on a full max was really negligible. And when you factor in the no state income tax in Florida and factor in that he could have claimed Florida residence for all of his income, and so the fact that he wouldn't have to pay state income tax on his Nike contract, whereas if he was living in Ohio, I think the state income tax was 7%.
Brian, a lot of people don't understand that one of the Miami Heat's advantages, and it's a big one, is right there. What you just said, we chalk it up to Pat Riley's charm, but when they get in the room with the GM Andy Ellisberg and he starts crunching the numbers for him and they see how much they can save in taxes, it gives Miami a nice little advantage over parts of the league.
One thing I will say, that they pay tax on every game they play in every state they play in. So if you sign with the Heat, it's not that you pay no state income tax. You still pay state income tax when you go play in New York, in Ohio, in Indiana. But you obviously have 41 home games, and you're going to have, you know, two games in Orlando, and then you're going to have three games in Texas and one game in Arizona where there's no state income tax. So you're still saving. If you're an individual who makes $50 to $100 million a year, as LeBron was, you're still saving millions of dollars that way. And so the concept that LeBron left money on the table by coming to the Heat isn't really maybe 100% accurate, but it irritated him in the long run that he wasn't on a max contract. But getting back to your original question, which was, where does basketball now rank? Since they've boosted the max salaries and since the salary cap has spiked and he is now making, I think he's making $40 million a year, that is now his biggest draw. But between Nike and his other investments, he is earning, you know, tens and tens of millions off the basketball court as well.
What is your relationship with him? What can we tell the people about the most headbutting time you guys have had? Because you've been covering him for so long, Brian, like my guess, and you do your job so well, and you try to be impartial, even though you're, you know, you get emotional when Cleveland wins things because you're from there, but you do your job objectively, and you've often run the wrong side of him. So what have been the most unpleasant moments?
Our relationship has never been the same since he went to Miami. Our relationship was always stronger with first time around in Cleveland, and it wasn't just me. The entire media scarred him after the decision. While I had institutional knowledge and could talk to him about things that maybe others couldn't, even when he was in Miami, our relationship was never the same after 2010. And I don't think it was any one thing that I did. I just think he looked at the media differently. And then really over the last 5 or 6 years, most of his one-on-one interviews are negotiated and or positioned. And I haven't done a one-on-one interview with him since maybe 2013. I mean, I've talked to him on the side, like non-set up in advance where we sit down in front of cameras or sit down.
But that all has to be amazing to you, right? Because you were there when it was nothing. At least, like, I don't know when you started in LeBron's life, like exactly. But was he already well down the fame path? Because you were the first guy sort of covering him, weren't you?
Yeah, that's always been people saying that. Like, I have never stood up and said, I am the all-time authority on him. For a long time, I...
You are. You've written books about him. You've been there at his side as he's become the modern version of Michael Jordan and Muhammad Ali taking stances. You've seen him grow from a kid who was just a high school kid with you. He was just a high school kid. You've seen him grow into this thing that allows you to write multiple books about him. And people smear you. Right. They get mad at you and they say, Windhorse, he's just a leech. He just makes money off LeBron. But you are the authority on this subject.
Well, yeah, I absolutely have benefited massively from my association with him. But the thing that I haven't been willing to do is partner with him. And so he is very much in a position in his career and has been for the last handful of years where, from a media standpoint, he's looking for partners. And I'm not looking to be his partner. And the irony is, and there's nothing I can do about it, so... But the irony is, like, the coldest we ever were to each other was that first year in Miami, where I was heavily criticized for going there. If I had gone there and was getting all of these exclusive interviews, he was telling me, like, oh, yeah, when I make my free agent decision, I will tell you and only you. I mean, I was criticized for being a sellout, but I didn't get the sale. I didn't get the proceeds.
Who was criticizing you? I mean, was this just civic pride? Like LeBron left, he's the villain, and Windhorse also left. He followed the money train, so he's the villain too.
Who's criticizing you? I didn't crawl across glass. I didn't storm Omaha Beach, so I'm not.
How does Big Z get off on all this? This is bullshit, Windhorse. Nobody comes after Big Z on it. He's allowed to come back and forth between Cleveland. Only you and LeBron get trampled.
He faced some downside, too. But, yeah, I mean, I was I faced a lot of criticism in Cleveland. And then when I got to Miami, I was criticized for, you know, being a follower. I mean, the reality was, you know this better than anybody, I just had to get out of newspapers. I had to. This was no, like, incredible foresight. It wasn't like I was like, oh, boy, I'm ahead of the market here. Newspapers were in deep, deep trouble.
Right.
You know, I interviewed for...
It was a pretty good career move, by the way, Brian. You did not to stay with the newspaper there.
Yeah, I mean, and no offense to the Plain Dealer. I loved working there, but I couldn't stay. And I had interviewed for like five other jobs in the year to 18 months before I took the ESPN.
You were a star reporter, right? You were a star reporter. You're a bit of a prodigy in this regard. Super responsible at a very young age, right?
I strived for that. I don't know if I was. I interviewed the first time at ESPN in 2007 or something, and I interviewed at the New York Times. When Adrian Wojnarowski was hired at Yahoo, I interviewed for the job. They made a very good choice to hire Woj ahead of me.
That dude, Brian, you guys marvel at it too? That fucking dude is crazy in terms of how it is that he can break those stories when all of you are plugged in. But nobody can be as plugged in as that dude. It's crazy. I've never seen anything like it in sports journalism.
He's the most amazing person at the most amazing time. I mean, in 2005, 2006, like, here's the way transactions worked. If you were on good terms with your organization, which wasn't always the case, but if you were, I remember vividly, like, 2005, 2006, you get a phone call on your cell phone. You'd be at lunch, and you get a phone call on your cell phone from the GM, and he'd say, hey, we just traded our 2008 second-round pick for Flip Murray. Oh, okay, cool. Why'd you do that? Well, we need some more scoring in our backcourt, and, you know, he was available. So, okay, cool. You wrote down a quote. You hung up the phone and said, all right, I'll finish lunch, run some errands, and get home at 4 o'clock and write that story. And the story ran the next day, okay? I mean, there was a currency in finding out, oh, boy, this guy wants out, or they're having trade discussions at the star level. There was not an urgency in the transaction game. The transaction game was record-keeping. It was not myth-making. And one of the things that Woj did, one of the things that, you know, he was trying to build a brand at Yahoo, and this was pre-Twitter, and he decided, I mean, Woj, by the way, is a fabulous columnist.
He is a great writer.
Actually, Woj is a better writer.
It's pretty close. I don't think people know that Woj might be as good as a writer as he is as a reporter.
Yeah, his reporting is so good. Let's put it this way. It's unfortunate, and I think even he would admit this, it's unfortunate that he has dedicated this era in his career to reporting. It's unfortunate that that has come at the casualty of him not being able to write columns anymore.
But that's happened to all of us, Brian. That's happened to all of us. ESPN bought all of us like that because everybody had to bail from newspapers. We all saw that everything was sinking, and so – ESPN bought all those guys, and now magazines are dead, and none of us write anymore. And you're out here still pimping these books, though. You're still out here being one of the few guys who does writing with everything else.
I'm trying. But so anyway, I interviewed Yahoo. They hired Woj. I mean, I was like trying to get jobs that were out of newspapers, even if they were away from LeBron. I just couldn't get one. That's life, I guess. So when he came to Miami, you know, ESPN offered me a job that was I'm trying to remember, was probably a 30% pay raise, but it was not easy. You know, I had to rip up my life. My now wife, we weren't married at the time, but she was in law school in Ohio. She couldn't move, so I had to move 1,000 miles away from her. I had to move 1,000 miles away from my family. It wasn't like, oh, I rode in on a private jet and immediately started staying in the penthouse at the Mandarin Oriental. I mean, it was not easy. And then I was heavily criticized both ways. That's why I had to go. And it just so happened that the opportunity came from ESPN. And by the way, I lived in Miami for 2 years. And then in 2012, I moved out of Miami full time and started living in New York City. And I haven't lived in the same city that LeBron has played in since 2012. Now, granted, I still came to Miami a lot. I still was in Cleveland a lot because I have family there. I was certainly very much in touch with them. I was, you know, riding side saddle in those title runs. And
this criticism bothers you, doesn't it, Brian? This criticism bothers you because you're not just the LeBron guy. And again, buy his new book, LeBron Inc., The Making of a Billion-Dollar Athlete. It's available now. I am positive that this is a good book because nobody reports this stuff and writes about LeBron this well. Come on now. It sounds like you're bothered or hurt by the idea of this is the LeBron guy when you've had a rich career of doing a lot of different things and you're good at them.
Well, I'm fine with it. It's just that I'm criticized for being a sellout when I didn't get the benefit of, you know, Lee Jenkins got the story. If I sold out, it was the worst sellout of all time because he may not have chosen me to partner with anyway. He may not have liked something that I said or did or liked the way I did business or whatever, but like, I have not chosen to pursue, nor has LeBron chosen to partner with me. When he made his biggest scoop reveal in history, it was with somebody else that wasn't me. So if I did sell out and I got all that stuff and I had co-written these books with LeBron and I had been a consultant for him and that I left ESPN to go be the media director.
You didn't sell out, Brian. You didn't sell out. You don't need to be bothered by anyone saying it.
Right, so that's the only thing. And you know, everybody's like, well, you know, he rides them, and I'm like, well, I've absolutely benefited. I wouldn't be here but for him. But I haven't even lived in the same city he's lived in 7 years.
I said at the beginning of this, I lied to you. I lied to your face, Brian. I said at the beginning of this that we weren't going to spend much time on LeBron, and a half hour later, I'm still here, and I haven't asked you about anything
else. That's fine, but I'm totally fine with that. Here's the thing. Like, I began to believe after LeBron's first season in Miami that he was not going to stay there long term and that, in fact, not only was he going to leave, but he was going to go back to Cleveland. And I started writing about this and talking about it, and I hedged it as much as I could.
I remember that, Brian. You were criticized so much. You were writing very early on, and it seemed ridiculous at the time because you were writing – was it in year two?
I really started to believe it in year two.
And people were calling you names, right? Everybody was saying, what does this asshole know?
Well, and the other thing was, like, I was criticizing the Heat for doing things, and they were so successful. The reason I was criticizing them is because I felt that they were making decisions that were driving LeBron away a little bit. And that was just, so it was very difficult for me in Cleveland because I was,
Brian, that makes sense, though. That makes so much sense what you're talking about. If LeBron has realized at 21 that he doesn't want to be the employee, that he wants to be the owner, if he knew that back at 21, it would make sense that any shortcuts taken that would undermine that he was already underpaid, if he was already thinking of himself in those terms, it would make sense that he would be thinking back then about how to put the puzzle pieces together so that he could actually turn into this billion-dollar thing you're writing books about.
Right, and he also wanted to be the player who the franchise did pretty much whatever he wanted. And that was just not going to be the way it was going to be in Miami. Now, this is a difficult gray area to speak about, and it's complicated. It's not that LeBron would walk into Mickey Arison's office and say, I want you to do A, B, and C. Press these three buttons right now or else. But it, the influence that he has in forcing the team to make short-term decisions that only would benefit what he wants. And basically, at the end of the day, even Dan Gilbert, who was willing to say yes to everything for years, eventually got tired of it, and when it came to trading Kyrie Irving, did what was best for the franchise and not what was best for LeBron. And that, I think he was already probably going to leave anyway, but that applied the grease to the skids. But LeBron decided he wanted that while he was at Miami, and he found someone willing to do that for him in his hometown. So,
what is the best of the stories that you've heard about the way Cleveland handed over the keys to the kingdom because he wanted to be the owner?
Well, let me just tell you a few stories. So, like, for example, when LeBron signed in Cleveland, the first thing that he did was call Kevin Love. 1 month before LeBron committed to Cleveland, the Cavs didn't think they were getting him. I swear to God, they did not think they were getting him. And they had some trade assets, and they called Minnesota and said, hey, do you think we could do a deal for Kevin Love? And he called Kevin Love's agent. And Kevin Lee, he said, hey, I think we may be able to trade for him. And he said, don't trade for him. He's not going to re-sign there. I'm telling you, I mean, if you want to trade for him, do it. But he's not re-signing there, so it's, you do it at your own peril. So LeBron commits. He immediately calls Kevin Love up personally and says, hey, I want to, let's play together. And Kevin Love's agent calls back to the Cavs and says, okay, Kevin now wants to play for you. Let's work together on a deal. Now, is that him calling the shots? Or is that him getting them a player that they couldn't have gotten otherwise? For example, like they were really trying to get Mike Miller to sign. Mike Miller was a free agent. He wasn't really interested in coming to Cleveland. I don't blame him. And LeBron signed there. LeBron called Mike Miller. Mike Miller called up or had his agent call up and say he's ready to sign. Okay, like when they, you know, when they were going to do a trade his first year, they came to him and said, hey, we can get him on Shumpert, who we really want, but they want to make us take J.R. Smith. We're not so sure about that. LeBron was like, bring J.R. Smith in, and I'll take care of him. I'll take him under my wing. Let's do this trade. Okay, is that LeBron calling the shots?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But then,
yes, all of those things are LeBron calling the shots.
Okay. So, but the one thing that I think is a black mark on his record, and he's done this at other times, but this is a legitimate thing, in my opinion. His last year in Cleveland, you know, he was upset about the Kyrie trade. He wasn't so much upset about the fact that they traded him, even though you could argue whether or not there was a leverage game that they could have reversed the leverage. I think he was upset at what they traded him for, which was essentially an injured player and a future draft pick. LeBron does not care about future draft picks. He just doesn't care about them. I'm trying to win tonight's game. I'm trying to win the championship this year. Don't talk to me about your 2019 first-round pick. I don't care about it. So midway through his last season in Cleveland, he was frustrated about the trade. Isaiah Thomas was a failure, and he was playing great. And this time in January came where he basically stopped playing as hard as he could. And it was his way of kind of forcing the Cavs into making trades to upgrade their roster. And if you remember, they traded half their roster at the trade deadline. And he almost immediately started playing great again. And
That's one of the weirdest things, Brian. It's one of the weirdest things. There are a handful of checked out accusations people make at his expense. The triple double game in Boston where it felt like he quit, this and the Miami Heat. I don't know. It'd be imperceptible, Brian, but the Miami Heat felt like LeBron knew during the finals, 1-1 against San Antonio, just sort of knew that he could take it down a notch. And San Antonio was playing wonderfully. And I've argued with people, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? But there have been questions about his effort level when he doesn't get his way. Or he needs to exit a place.
I would say this about 2010. I've said this before. I just think he choked against the Celtics. And I think he choked the next year against the Mavericks. You know, he played, in my view, he had a couple of good performances, but in my view, he played way worse in the 2011 finals than he did in the 2010 series against the Celtics. He was called a quitter against the Celtics, whereas against the, he played the worst game of his career, and it probably cost him a title. His 8-point game. He had an 8-point game. This is a guy who has set the record for consecutive double-digit scoring games in NBA history. He has more than Kareem. He has more than Jordan. And you have to say regular season games, because back in the 2011 finals, he had an 8-point playoff game in Dallas where he basically choked. So to me, 2010 and 2011, he was struggling with the pressure. And it wasn't until he made some mental changes that he overcame that. To me, that's different than what happened his last year in Cleveland, where, and I honestly believe, he did not have his heart in it. And here's the strange thing about it. And I can't necessarily say to you that he's wrong. He, in a way, I believe, because I have never specifically asked him about this, but I have a feel for this. I believe he felt like he was showing good leadership by forcing the Cavs to trade half their roster for a better team. And by the way, they made those trades and ended up getting to the finals. Now, they were outclassed in the finals, but those trades helped them get there. I don't think he would ever spike a playoff series to prove a point, but I do think he was willing to shut down in the regular season to prove a point. Had the Cavs not made those trades at the trade deadline, I believe he would have picked it back up again, but I think he was absolutely sending a message. And the same thing I thought might have been happening his first year in Cleveland when he was upset playing for David Blatt, but he did have a back issue at the time, and he did have to get him.
Well, what about the San Antonio series? Because it's not something I've heard very much of. When I hear it from anyone around the Heat, and you'll hear it more than a few places, that he was ready to go, that at that point the Miami Heat would have won their third straight championship. It was 1-1. The two games in San Antonio were very close, and then everything fell apart in the last three games. So the suspicion that he was, you know, playing LeBron James hard, performance-wise, he could go whatever it was, 28-7-7, but he wasn't actually, he'd already left. He'd mentally left.
I didn't get that feel. To me, that was a Heat team that was completely and utterly exhausted, no energy left whatsoever. I've talked many times about the locker room after Game 5. I've never experienced anything like that. It was not euphoria is the wrong word, but it was a punch drunk because they were so exhausted. They were just happy it was over.
Happy it was over, even though they lost. At the end, San Antonio, you know, was playing the best basketball ever, and they all knew, they all kind of knew it was over except for Bosch.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's a hard sell to me because LeBron was far and away the Heat's best player in that series. There was nobody even anywhere close. I mean, they were starting, I think, in Game 5. I think Rashard Lewis started. He was one of the starting players for the Heat. And I'm pretty sure there was at least four or five guys who played. I don't have this in front of me, so I'm going to have to beg your forgiveness if I'm a little bit off. But I think the Heat played eight guys in Game 5, the last game, and four of them never played again, or three of them never played again, because Battier, Ray Allen, and Rashard Lewis never played again.
So it was the last game. So you're saying that everybody on the court was on their literal last legs in their playing career.
Right. So, like, yeah, and like LeBron had carried them in Game 1, and only he collapsed because of the heat and had the cramps. And he had, they collapsed after he went out of the game, and that he was huge in Game 2 for them. And then, so, I mean, it's a hard sell for me. You know, I have always defended him about the 2010 series, that he didn't quit, that he was just, that he choked. And I've never, people push back on me so hard, and I was like, I can't believe that I'm calling somebody a choker and you're saying that I'm defending him. It's one of those things I could never quite understand. But I wasn't in the locker room. I wasn't, on the bench. I can't say for sure. I do know this. Whenever a player leaves, a star player leaves, there are always hard feelings. And like we're seeing it now, like where there's, all these, out of the side of their mouth complaints about, like, the way Kawhi treated the Raptors in the end and used and played them or whatever. There is no good way to leave. And when you leave, especially in kind of a shock like that was, I think it's human nature to go back and say, well, we didn't even need him anyway because he wasn't doing this. I, LeBron was the finals MVP the two previous years. He was, he should have been the MVP of the league his first 3 years in Miami. He wasn't his first year for various reasons. I don't think in fairness you could say he didn't give his all. And ultimately, even though I will tell you that I think LeBron shut down a little bit in his last season in Cleveland, the basketball that he played from February to June was some of the finest basketball he's ever played in his life. So even though I didn't, I charge him with that, you know, flaw, he responded by playing the highest level almost ever. And how can you look at him in the end and say, boy, you didn't do enough for your team? I mean, it's a preposterous thing to say, in all honesty.
Yep. Uh-huh. New book, LeBron, Inc., The Making of a Billion-Dollar Athlete. It's available now. You should get it because he writes very well about LeBron, micro and macro. One question as we get you out of here. I can't believe we did this whole f***ing thing on LeBron.
Yes, but that's what people want. They don't want to hear about anything else. They want to hear about LeBron.
Well, but I want to hear, though, because I didn't know that you had had a coma. I didn't know that until somebody told me, and I'm just curious. What happened? Like, what were the ramifications? How scary was all that? Because I've never talked to you about it.
Pretty scary. This was back in 2008. That was the year, to put it in LeBron perspective, that the Celtics had won the title. LeBron had gone to the finals with the Cavs the year before in that sort of shock year where he really arrived on the scene. Then the next year they lost in a great seven-game second-round series, one of the best series I've ever covered, that seven-game series against the Celtics. In Game 7, he had 45 and Paul Pierce had 41. All-time great game. It's not really remembered. I had felt ill like the entire second half of the season. I was seeing doctors and getting tests, and they really didn't know what it was, and I was sort of getting worse and worse. And you know, I had a home in Palm Beach County that I had for years, way before LeBron ever came to Miami. That was another thing, is I had family in South Florida, which was another reason to come, but you know, that didn't matter. Nobody cared about that. I rented it out. It was an investment property, which went great because you know the South Florida real estate in the 2000s was
Stop defending yourself against sellout claims, Brian. Stop it. Knock it off. I'm asking you about a goddamn coma.
I was going to get my tonsils out because I was 30 years old. I didn't have my tonsils out, and they thought that that was potentially causing an issue. And I was going to get my tonsils out like on the following Monday or Tuesday. And I was feeling so bad over the weekend on that Saturday. It was in June. The season had ended. But I went to the emergency room. And basically, they discovered that I was in terrible shape and that various systems were shutting down. And they put me in a coma, basically, so they could treat me. And I didn't know how bad it was. As you keep getting the test results back, you know, they start to get more and more concerned, and then they take you to the ICU, and then the doctor leans over at you and says, hey, we're going to put you to sleep for a little bit. And you wake up, and I missed the entire draft. I missed the entire free agency. I woke up like 20-something days later. It was kind of weird to hear all of NBA free agency like read to me like transactionally. And I had an autoimmune disorder that was unfortunately for me very rare, and you don't catch it. It just exists. It's not like it was inherited or that I had done something wrong. You just have it. It just exists. And but the good news about it was that it is treatable. The hard thing is finding it, and people die when you can't find it. And I progressively got worse for a period of days, and more organs shut down, and I got really on the brink. And then they found it. Some technicians and doctors who were really smart found it, and then they started treating me, and it was just a matter of sort of bringing me back. And so I was in a coma for 3 weeks, in the hospital for 2 months. And you know, when you are in a coma for 3 weeks, what happens to your body is unbelievable. You wouldn't believe it. You can't walk. You have to learn how to walk again. So that was an ordeal that I went through. But my family got the worst of it because they were the ones who kept getting the bad news while I was in the coma. But I had felt progressively worse for 4 or 5 months. So it didn't like all of a sudden come on, but I was seeing these doctors, and no, it's not mono, no, it's not this, blah, blah, blah. So it was a crazy thing to happen. And I when you come out of a coma, you know, it takes like a day or two for you to wake up from it. You don't just snap your fingers and like you're with it. And I wish I remember what I thought when I realized that it was July 17th or whatever, and the last thing I remembered was like June 21st. I wish I remembered, but I don't. I don't remember my first reaction. What I do know is that whenever you're in a coma, they're not 100, like if you're down for that long and they've put you on that many medications, they're not always 100% sure what you know, that you're going to come out of it A-okay mentally. And so one of my colleagues who I was working with at the time came in and was literally reading me the transactions of everything that happened. And he was the summer where the 76ers signed Elton Brand. And he told me how much they signed him for. And I said, I don't think that they have that much cap space because of Andre Iguodala's cap hold. And when I was, I later found out that when I was talking about the 76ers salary cap position, they figured I was actually going to be okay.
I mean, but, you are such a dork, though, Brian. Honest to God, measuring a coma by basketball transactions, and then like that is you're both a bad.
I'm trying to time and place. I'm trying to be considerate of our listeners.
You're both a badass and a dork because I'm interested. Do you remember anything? Like you weren't? Did you hear any voices? Is there anything from those 22 days, anything that you were trapped inside your body that you could remember?
No. And this is what I know that, like, for anybody, you know, I can only speak for what happened to me. But, you know, for people, anybody who's in a medical coma, like, there's no suffering. It was just blackness. I did have one of the first things I remember, that was the summer of the.
Oh, for the love of God. You're going to do the basketball thing again.
No, I'm actually not. That was the summer. It was McCain-Obama were in the presidential election. And Sarah Palin had kind of come onto the scene while I was in the coma. And I remember coming out of the coma and, like, sort of catching up and going, who the hell is this, person? But in the coma, I remember, like, two dreams. And one of the dreams I had was about the governor of Alaska, even though I didn't know who she was. So I must have been dreaming as I was coming out of the coma. I must have heard something about that. That's the only, like, thing. But, like, people have asked me who have had family members in comas, like, you know, do you remember anything? Was there any pain? You know, we go and talk to them. There was just nothing. Those drugs are pretty amazing. I remember the guy leaning. I do remember vividly the doctor leaning over me saying, we're going to put you to sleep now. They were just coming, like, for 3 or 4 days, they would come into my room and pull tubes out of me. And I go, oh, I didn't even realize that tube was in me. You know, you're sort of out of it for a while. So, the worst part for me was being in the rehab. And frankly, I was in the rehab with a lot of stroke victims. There was a lot of people who were not going to recover or were going through very hard recoveries, whereas I was improving. You know, I was.
You were showboating. You were wandering around, you know, giving Iguodala cap numbers.
Right. I mean, I was 30 years old. What I'll never forget is there was this guy in the rehab unit in the hospital, because I stayed in the hospital to do the rehab, who had lost both of his legs in a motorcycle accident, and it wasn't his fault. He was driving through an intersection and someone ran a red light. I think it was a drunk driver, hit him, he lost both of his legs. And he was so distraught that he couldn't even do anything, like, for days and days and days. He was the only other person in there who was under, like, 50 or 60 years old was this guy. He was probably maybe 5 or 6 years older than me. And, like, I remember talking to him because you just try to find somebody you can gravitate towards. And, you know, that was sort of my inspiration in a strange way, is that, like, no matter what was going to happen, because I was really frustrated by having to learn to walk again, learn to stand again. When you can't stand up on your own, you begin to resent people who come in to see you. Like, these people come to see you and they bring you food and they bring you flowers. I mean, Mike Brown, the Cavs coach, came to visit me in the hospital. Danny Ferry, the GM, came to visit me in the hospital. LeBron sent me a note, and then when he saw me, spoke to me very kindly about that. But I resented people who could just stand up. So I remember thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to end up walking out of here at the end of this. So that, I was very fortunate that happened to me when I was younger so I could recover from it, and I did fully recover. But I have thought many times in recent weeks about Dan Gilbert, who I have not seen eye to eye on many, many times. You know, and we actually have been at a place where we weren't speaking because he's so angry at me because I have covered him in what I would consider objectively, but he probably thinks unfairly over the years. But Dan Gilbert's recovering from a stroke right now. And I can't relate to what it's like to recover from a stroke, but I can relate to what it's like to be in that in that rehab unit, going through day by day of that, just of that situation. I can't, I can't relate to it, but I have a feeling for what he's, I have no idea what he's really going through, but I have a feeling for what he's going through. So, you know, you never forget that, even though it's 11 years in my past and doesn't affect me today. I'm very fortunate that I don't have to even take medication for it now. But certainly it was a huge, huge transitional moment in my life. So it is one of those things where, you know, when things occasionally don't work out for you, which happens in life, right? You're like, well, all right, it didn't work out, but, you know, I had last rights.
Brian, you know? I've got to salute you. I've told you, like, I really admire your work. You're a badass. You've been very good at your job for a long time, and you really don't need to defend yourself against anybody saying that you're a sellout anymore. But I bet you we shocked these motherfucking listeners out there when we turned 45 minutes of LeBron talk into the plot twist of with a light coma ending, with some coma talk at the end of all of that LeBron talk.
You always want to end a conversation with coma talk.
Yes.
That's always
some deep, deep, light coma talk. So thank you, Brian, for always being good at your job and for spending an hour with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Our thanks to Brian Windhorst. It's been a busy couple of months around here, so South Beach Sessions is going to take next week off, but we remind you to support the Levitard and Friends stuff on the network. Marty Smith was in studio here this week. Marty Smith's America is worth checking out. Also, follow at Levitard Show on Instagram and Twitter. Our merch store is someplace where you could get some stuff to support what it is that we're doing around here if you want to represent outside of listening to the show. So we will talk to you in 2 weeks. We've got some good stuff planned, so thank you for staying with us.